Well, good evening and a very warm welcome one and all to the first buzz-free Dr. Rock's radio show for a long time now on peoplesinternetradio.com. So, first of all, I think field medals and many, many thanks to Dr. Rock's surgery software team who have gone well above and beyond the call of duty over the last 4 or 5 days and nights. But Jimmy and Tim and Nick out there, thank you so much, really, for making it work, because it was getting very frustrating. And hopefully we can encourage more people over to open source software now that we've got a solution that is really cool and allows us to do everything we wanted to do. Well, tonight we've got a bit of a show. I'm hopefully going to be sharing the new physical microphone with Synchro. We'll be talking a little bit about the Bach flower remedies. It's a subject we've touched on before. Tonight we're going to hear Synchro reading 10 or 12 minutes or so of an introduction to Mechthild Schaefer's book on Bach flower remedies, which endeavours to explore by what means these remedies work. And then we're going to talk a little bit about how Edward Bach grouped his 38 remedies, because there's 38 of them in all, and he put them in little groups that were designed to do a given thing, and Synchro will be talking to us about that. There might be one or two podcasts that I've picked up off YouTube, little short ones that I found either informative or entertaining. And at the very end of the show, we've had a lot of requests to have Synchro's voice doing a bit more storytelling. She's still working on a new narrative to put out there, but we thought we'd treat you to Dylan Thomas's The Outing, which is a poem, basically, as far as I can tell, it's about a pub crawl, but it's a very amusing tale, and that's what we'll hopefully have at the end of the show. Now, later on in the show, after a bit of a music break and this next bit, we'll be talking to Synchro, hopefully, about the Bach flower remedies. She likes to say Bach flower remedies, by the way. We're told by the people down the Batch Flower Remedy Centre in Oxford that the correct pronunciation is Batch, but being Welsh, she just can't quite bring herself to do that and prefers Bach, so that's what we're going to call him. We've got now a little bit of the introduction from Mechthild Schaefer's book called How Do introduction's called How Do the Remedies Work, and the book's called Bach Flower Therapy, and I think it's one of, even after all these years, it's still one of Synchro's favourites. And she has, as I think recent listeners will remember, become much more interested in the Bach flower remedies again and has started using them out in the field. I've experienced them myself. They were actually the first proper healing type thing I ever tried outside allopathic medicine, like. And I must admit, I found them very useful over time. I know many people as well who carry around the rescue remedy in their packets and in their first aid kits and stuff. And I know some people have used them with great effect in quite surprising places. I think they're becoming much more mainstream. And it's interesting to hear how it is that the resonance of these simple flower essences can, in some cases, have quite a profound effect on the people that take them. I know several people now round and about me who are receiving bottles of special stuff from Synchro, and it's very interesting to watch to see what happens. So here we go. Here's Synchro with a nice bit of background of birds and a bit of wind and a bit of rain and all of that, reading from Mechthild Schaefer's book, and she's reading the section of the introduction called How Do the Remedies Work. I'll be back with you in about 15 minutes or so, and I should think that Synchro will be with me as well, for those of you out there who are fans of her lovely voice.
Taken from Mechthild Schaefer's book, Bach Flower Therapy, Theory and Practice. Edward Bach's interpretation of how the remedies might work. In 1934, Bach wrote the following concerning the way his flower remedies work. The action of these remedies is to raise our vibrations and open up our channels for the reception of the spiritual self, to flood our natures with the particular virtue we need, and wash out from us the fault that is causing the harm. They are able, like beautiful music or any glorious uplifting thing which gives us inspiration, to raise our very natures, and bring us nearer to our souls, by that very act to bring us peace and relieve our sufferings. They cure not by attacking the disease, but by flooding our bodies with the beautiful vibrations of our higher nature, in the presence of which disease melts away as snow in the sunshine. There is no true healing unless there is a change in outlook, peace of mind, and inner happiness. To many people this may at first sound improbable, but it becomes perfectly clear if the premise on which Bach based his line of thought, similar to Hippocrates, Hahnemann, and Paracelsus, great men of like spirit, is understood and accepted. Human life, man, on this planet, is but part of a greater concept of creation. We live within a wider frame of reference, a more comprehensive unity, more or less like a cell within the human body. Every person is two things, a unique individual and a vital and essential part of the greater unity, the greater whole. Within creation, there is unity in all things, and each of us is related to everything else by a common, more powerful form of energy that has been given many names, for instance, creative force, universal life principle, cosmic principle, love, or maybe God. Like everything else in our universe, from frost patterns on our windows to the generation and death of whole planetary systems, the development of every individual human being follows a programmed course of action and reaction, an inherent law. Every human being has a matrix with specific energy potentials, has a mission, a task, a destiny, karma, or whatever we may like to call it. Being part of the great plan of creation, every human being has an immortal soul, his real self, and a mortal personality, that which he represents here on earth. There is a higher self, which is closely bound up with his soul, and may be said to function as the mediator between soul and personality. The soul is aware of the particular mission a person has, and endeavours to bring this mission to expression with the aid of the higher self, and through the flesh and blood personality, and make it a concrete reality. To begin with, the personality is not aware of this mission. The potentials our soul wishes to bring to realization through the personality are not concrete. They are in fact higher, ideal qualities that Edward Bach referred to as the virtues of our higher self. They include gentleness, firmness, courage, constancy, wisdom, joyfulness, and purposefulness. Poets from all ages have praised these as noble qualities of character. They could also be called ideal, archetypal soul qualities of mankind, the realization of which will lead to true happiness within the context of a greater whole. If these are not brought to realization, the opposite feeling, unhappiness, will sooner or later develop. The potential virtues which we have failed to realize now show themselves from their negative side as defects such as pride, cruelty, hatred, self-love, ignorance, and greed. These defects, as not only Edward Bach tells us, are the true causes of disease. Every person has the unconscious desire to live in harmony, for nature, considered as a huge energy field, is always endeavouring to produce the most effective energy state. If the personality could and would act wholly in harmony with its soul, which itself is part of the greater whole, man would be living in perfect harmony. The universal divine creative energy would be able to express itself through the soul and the higher self in the personality, and we would be strong, fit, and happy people. Our energy is in harmony with the great cosmic energy field of which we are a part. Wherever the personality is not connected to the great cosmic energy field by its soul, not swinging in harmony with it, there is disruption, congestion, friction, distortion, disharmony, and loss of energy. These conditions are first present in subtle, non-material form, but then progress to the material level, manifesting first in the form of negative moods and later in physical illness. The function of physical illness is that of a final corrective. To put it simply, it is a red warning light, very clearly indicating that something has to be done immediately, for otherwise total failure will follow sooner or later. Edward Bach said that two basic errors are the real cause of disease. The first error being that the personality is not acting in accord with its soul, but persists in the illusion of being separate from it. At the absolute extreme, the personality is no longer in a position even to recognize the existence of the soul and of a higher self, materialistically accepting only what can be seen and touched. In the long run, it thus cuts its own umbilical cord, withers, and destroys itself. More often, however, the personality merely misunderstands the soul's intentions in certain respects, and then acts according to its limited understanding of the situation. In all the separate areas where the personality has turned away from the great cosmic energy flow, or from love, as Edward Bach put it, virtues, i.e., positive character traits, are distortive and become destructive, leading to negative soul states and moods. The second error is that the personality acts against the principle of unity. By acting against the intentions of its higher self and soul, the personality is automatically also acting against the interests of the greater unity, its soul being linked to it in terms of energy. Above all, however, the personality is acting against the principle of unity if it attempts to force its own will on another being, against the will of the latter. This not only impedes the development of the other, but also, all things being related, upsets the whole cosmic energy field, i.e. the development of mankind as a whole. Any illness is preceded by a negative state of soul, due to one of the great archetypal human soul qualities or virtues being misused. Here is an example. The negative state of soul might be inconsiderate, egotistical attitudes arising from greed as a wrongly used virtue. Greed is the negative side of the soul quality of love for one's neighbour and tolerance. In Heal Thyself, Edward Bach wrote, "Greed leads to a desire for power. It is a denial of the freedom and individuality of every soul. Instead of recognizing that every one of us is here to develop freely upon his own lines, according to the dictates of the soul alone, to increase his individuality and to work free and unhampered, the personality with greed desires to dictate, mould, and command, usurping the power of the Creator, or the creative life force. Each of such defects, if persisted in against the voice of the higher self, will produce a conflict which must, of necessity, be reflected in the physical body, producing its own specific type of malady. The result of greed and domination of others is such diseases as will render the sufferer a slave to his own body, with desires and ambitions curbed by the malady. Bach bases his diagnosis on the law of the soul, a higher principle of cause, and not, like other schools of medicine in the Western world, on the limited aspect of personality and the sphere of physical action. Edward Bach did not use the physical symptoms to make his diagnosis, but solely and entirely the negative soul states that are the consequence of conflict in carrying out the intentions of soul and personality, and may in the end lead to physical illness. These negative soul states are not, however, treated as symptoms to be fought, for that would maintain them in their energy. Instead, they are flooded, as it were, with higher, harmonious energy waves, so that they melt away as snow in the sunshine, as Bach put it. How can we picture this? The flowers used by Bach are from certain plants of a higher order, as he called it. Each embodies a certain soul quality, or to put it in energetic terms, has a particular energy wavelength. Each of these plant-based soul qualities is in tune with a certain soul quality in a person, i.e. with a certain frequency in the human energy field. The human soul contains all 38 soul qualities of the Bach flowers as energy potentials, virtues, or divine sparks. When conflict has arisen between the intentions of soul and a personality within a certain soul quality or energy potential, the wavelength in the energy field is distorted at that point. It is out of harmony and slowed down. Such a distortion will have a negative effect on the person's whole psyche, and as Edward Bach put it, a negative state of mind and soul develops. How does a flower remedy act in such a situation? The flower remedy has the same harmonious energy frequency as the human soul quality concerned, but in this case without distortion and at the normal rhythm. It therefore has an affinity to the human soul quality and is able to establish contact with it and with its own harmonious frequency waves re-establish harmony in the soul. Music and colour therapy are based on similar principles. To put it another way, the Bach flower remedy acts as a form of catalyst, re-establishing contact between the soul and personality at the point where this has become broken. The soul is able to communicate its intentions to the personality again. Life returns to an area where disharmony and rigidity has taken over, or as Bach has said, the human being becomes very much himself again at a point where he had ceased to be quite himself. The personality, caught up in the confusion and restriction that is only too human, finds a way out again, back to the soul qualities or virtues that give meaning to our existence on this planet and bring harmony. Simplicity is the basic principle for the use of the flower remedies. The term simplicity tends to be misunderstood in a world of increasing sophistication, being sometimes equated with primitiveness. Simplicity has to do with unity, perfection, and harmony. That is the reason why everybody feels attracted to the simple things in life, however vaguely. To perceive the unity and simplicity that lies behind even the greatest differentiation and apparent complexity of a process, it is necessary to have not only objectivity, perceptiveness, and the ability to grasp the whole, but also a fundamental readiness to see oneself as part of a whole, a part that in the final instance is governed by a unified, simple, creative principle. It cannot be without reason that practically all the great scientists have, at the end of their lives, come to accept this view. It is the primary aim and outcome of Bach flower therapy to restore and reaffirm this fundamental attitude in every human being.
Are you an economy with performance issues? If it's hard to achieve and maintain growth, maybe Stimulus is right for you. Take Stimulus once every election cycle or whenever you're in need of economic enhancement. Economies with top-heavy debt loads and high tax burdens should not use Stimulus. Stimulus has many active ingredients, but they are poorly understood by economists. Side effects may include hyperinflation, stagnation, dollar devaluation, earmarks, excessive debt, bankruptcy, loss of jobs, growth of welfare state, expansion of nanny state, unrealized expectations, economic impotence, depression, halitosis, and sweaty palms. Stimulus has not been proven successful, so it should not be used in the hopes of achieving actual growth. Stimulus, because all economies have performance issues.
There you go, that was Reason TV's little Stimulus advert. I thought that was quite funny. And before that, Rob Harran and the Teapad Orchestra and Bank Failures. And before that, we had Synchro reading Mechthild Schaefer and How Do the Bach Flower Remedies Work. But I'm now joined live by Synchro again. Thank you very much, Synchro, for coming back.
No problem. Hi, everybody.
And I gather you've been, well, I know you've been getting back in, right back into the Bach Flower Remedies, haven't you?
Yep.
And I think you're probably getting as much enjoyment out of it as the people that you're talking to. In fact, there's a message in the chat box from Jay saying, hey, the Bach Flower Remedy's working very well. So how's it going, your reinvestigation of this old interest?
Well, as I was saying to Jay the other night, really, I realised I've got this box of tools, box of tools, and I haven't been using them. And basically, I've used them for myself over the years and for a few close people and maybe in some extreme circumstances. But it's occurred to me recently that many people can benefit from this system. It's very simple to use. And the skill of the practitioner basically is to familiarize themselves with the remedies sufficiently to be able to choose the best remedy for that person at that time. That's the skill, basically.
I know you find remedies popping into your mind all the time whilst you're just kind of wandering around seeing people and watching them, doesn't it?
Well, I can't help myself, you know. If I'm watching a movie or reading a book, I quite often think, oh, I wish I could give them some beech or a drop of vine or something like that, yeah. Watching a film, yeah, definitely. You want to give them remedies all the time.
And of course, it's all about we're used to hearing, aren't we, about resonance and vibration, and about we know that the water can have basically frequencies played at it, and it has the same effect as adding whatever chemical that frequency represents to the water. So, resonance and what we consider to be things are in fact the same thing. And one of the things that introduction really concentrated on was the idea of raising our vibration and flooding our nature with what he called virtue was needed, and wash out the fault that causes harm. I guess, first of all, we need to clear up that by using words like virtue and harm, we're not actually using pejorative language, are we? We have specific things in mind.
Yeah, like you said earlier, I think, is that virtue here is being used to describe any positive character trait. It's not being used in a judgmental sense. It's Bach quite often uses quite old styly religious language, which has to be translated for the modern day user, I think, where religion maybe isn't as strong in many of our minds these days.
And I guess if virtue means positive character traits, then when he's talking about faults, he's talking about things that prevent us from showing ourselves in our greatest light, really. Some of those, I guess, rise from within. Some of them occur as a result of our own background. And some of them must be occurring just as a result of the world we live in, don't you think?
Certainly, yeah. I mean, the negative traits or the negative moods that he describes as leading to the need for some of these essences are fairly obvious and fairly easy to recognise to somebody who's really familiar with the action of each remedy, which is what I've been doing recently, is revising this whole system. It's basically quite simple, but there are 38 remedies, which takes a bit of revision, and you need to learn about them, as we'll come into, I think. We need to learn about them in relationship to each other. It's not just It's often not a single remedy you give, but one, two, or maybe three. I like not to give more than three, but it's about choosing the right remedies and the right combination of remedies to work for that person at that time.
And it is a bit like peeling an onion, isn't it? It may be that it occurs to you that that maybe more than three remedies might be relevant, but you choose what you think are the core three to start with, and then find out what effect they have on the individual, and then you can look again. And they do change, don't they, over time?
They certainly do. You know, if you offer, say, I don't know, three sessions to somebody, then it's quite likely that one or even two of the remedies chosen at the first session will carry on into the second and third mixtures. But they can change. It's quite often the case that somebody will need one particular remedy for quite some time, because sometimes we're working on very deep, well-ingrained issues and habits and conditions that have been inspired in the individual. So you are actually treating the person right back to the beginning of their existence, right back to, I guess you might say, right back to conception, when that individual was first brought to the planet.
Yeah, and I suppose if you're going to be dealing with things that have been going on for that long, then the first remedies are likely to last a little bit longer than the ones that come thereafter.
Yeah, and apparently each of these 38 remedies can be used as what is known as a type remedy. So it's quite likely that your type remedy, you'll be needing it on and off throughout your life, mm-hmm. because it is part of who you are. But it's about bringing that into the most positive manifestation that we can through the taking of that remedy, and to, bring out the positive aspects of the taking of that remedy. Not because it's by the negative aspects that we recognise the need for the remedy, and then the transformation begins to take place.
What do we think about this suggestion in the essay there, that there can be no true healing unless there's a change in outlook, especially one that leads toward peace of mind and inner happiness? Do we think that's important?
We certainly do. Well, I do anyway. I think that any change in outlook that is going to benefit the person and the people that they deal with is going to be an inner change. It's going to be coming from within that person, because any superficial change in outlook won't last. You know, it needs to be quite a deep inner transformation, I think, which is why I like to focus on the inner person, if you like, because you're with the Bach remedies, you're communicating with the person behind the behavior, if you like, but through recognizing the behavior, you're able to treat the person. Because quite often people hide behind their behaviors. Like, you know, anger is a very popular one, that people will get angry to hide behind their anger and not to reveal their more sensitive nature, their more sensitive person, if you like, that lies behind that behavior.
It's always struck me that actually, I mean, as major a part of these particular therapies as the flower essences themselves is the conversation that goes on before you decide. I mean, some people douse, and you douse occasionally, don't you? But you prefer extensive conversation to find out where somebody's coming from, because it gives you something better to judge it against. How do the two methods compare, the dowsing and the conversation?
Well, I don't think you can beat the chat, to be honest, because I think, although I know dowsing works, I think when you're diagnosing for somebody else, it's much better to get things from their point of view and to ask the right questions to get the information you need to make the correct choice about the remedy for that person. I quite often will, if I'm thinking about a diagnosis for somebody, I might check some things out with dowsing. Or if there's a few remedies to choose from for that person, I might check that out with dowsing. But actually, the more familiar one becomes with the remedies and the differences between them and the differences of action that each one has, the less doubt there is and the less need there is to back up with techniques like dowsing. Although, you know, everybody's free to use whatever method they find is helpful and useful for them.
And I guess if you have extensive conversations with people, it's harder for them to do things like hide behind jealousy, fear and anger and the like, isn't it? Because as they relax and talk more, you get to learn a little bit more about where they're coming from.
Yeah, I think a chat, especially, I mean, if you know the person, you know, a bit to start with, then you're probably aware of their kind of general tendencies and approach to life and how that manifests. So you've got a head start. If it's somebody you've never met before, I mean, you know, just being in their presence and being aware of body language and eye contact and all those other things that are beyond words that we've talked about before are so important and so revealing, because basically you're trying to read the person to a sufficient extent without being invasive, because that's one of the things I really like about the remedies, is that when somebody's describing a problem or a difficulty they're having to you, you can then come back with something very positive. You're saying, well, I've got this particular little tool in my box here that is made just for helping with that thing you've just described to me there, you know.
Yeah.
So it's like I say, I've got these tools in a box and it's not me that's doing the healing. And the remedy is going to act with the whole being of that person that's being given the essences, it's going to work with the whole person, and it's them and their higher selves that are doing the healing, not me.
Yeah, the higher self thing appears to be quite important as well. They're constantly emphasizing that it's important that people feel that they're part of a greater concept of creation, a kind of wider frame of reference, a more comprehensive unity. And we're hearing that quite regularly now, because I know Juliet in the ceremonies emphasizes that, and you've been listening to that Tom Ryan show, haven't you, that he did with Vin, and he was emphasizing how important it is that we recognize this kind of fractal aspect of ourselves, that we're really two things, aren't we?
Yeah, that's right. We're all unique individuals, and we're also all a part, significant part, unique and significant part of the greater whole. And these two things go together incredibly well once we've unified them within ourselves. To know that we made up a word, didn't we? Unificant, yeah. Which means unique and significant, but as each of us is, but in also connecting to the universe, because I think the higher self, call it what you like, but that's the name that Bach's given to it, is the communication, if you like, the mediator between the universal and our personal physical selves. So it's where we probably get our best advice from. You know, people talk about having advisors on different shoulders, giving them different kinds of advice and stuff. We probably know when we're getting good advice from our inner navigator, as we've talked about before in relation to kinesiology. You know, we know when that's happening. So it's basically to go with that, follow it through and see what happens and see if it works for you, because the more you do it, the more likely you'll find that it does.
Yeah.
Synchronicities.
Synchronicities, yeah. I guess we'll get to talk about that, well, a little later, because really one of the manifestations of not being with the right frequency and stuff is a kind of stuckness and stuff, as we'll come across. But basically what we're saying is that the higher self mediates between the soul and the personality, and that the soul and the higher self together are bringing our mission here into manifestation. They're kind of making it a concrete reality between them, and that these missions, if you like, are expressions of potential, kind of ideal qualities, which when manifested are the virtues of the higher self.
Yeah, you could call them that. Virtues just being positive aspects of the personality.
Yeah.
We don't want to get too bogged down in the judgmental of virtues. But can I just mention the African thing here?
Yeah, go for it.
We heard about a tribe in Africa, and what they did when a woman became pregnant was that they would work with the unborn child while it was still inside the mother to detect, if they could, to glean what the propensities or the talents and abilities of this new soul were going to be. And they also worked with the mother so that when the child was born, the village and the community would have a really good idea of what the, the main talents and inclinations of this new soul were going to be.
So they're working with it energetically from the moment it arrives in this plane, really, and using their mental abilities sort of, yeah.
Basically, they were using shamanic techniques to communicate with the unborn soul before it became manifest. So even leading up to conception, but especially after conception and up to birth, they're working with the unborn baby. And then the whole village, like I say, has a clearer idea, and everybody then will encourage those gleaned character traits and talents and abilities so that the child will be led in that direction and supported in those talents. It's something we really don't do.
It is very different from the West. I was going to say that in that we don't really pay any attention to children at all until they actually spring screaming from the womb, and sometimes not even then.
Yeah, it's very true. Very true.
Yeah. So Edward Bach then emphasises what he calls some of these virtues of the higher self. And it's interesting to think, I really like these lists of words and characteristics, because it gives you a chance to think about where you come across them and where you don't. And this is a particularly nice list because he includes gentleness and firmness, which seem to me to be kind of contrasts, courage and constancy, wisdom and joyfulness, and purposefulness. And he says that they all lead to true happiness, and he calls them ideal soul qualities. What do you think he means by that?
Well, what were the first two? Gentleness and firmness together. Well, I'm putting them together because I actually think they're really, really strongly connected, because I think there is such a thing as firm gentleness. Like your main intention is to be gentle, but that there needs to be a firmness in the communication of that intention. Because sometimes you have to, they say, what about being honest, you know? Sometimes it can be a bit brutal. Honesty can be a bit brutal.
Yeah.
Or your definition of the term honesty can be a bit brutal. But if it's put across with gentle intent in a firm sort of way, then you can say a lot of things that would otherwise be misreceived.
And sometimes these messages had to be given, don't they, really?
Well, that's part of the art of diagnosing for these remedies, actually, is finding out what you think needs a remedy, and then putting that across in a way that isn't negative to the person who needs the remedy. It would be very easy to put these remedies across in a very negative way that wouldn't inspire people towards their own healing at all. But that's not what I want to do, and that's not what Bach wanted us to do. He wanted us to be working with the potential positive transformation that would result from taking the correct remedy. So you're working on the positive, you're instantly working on the positive potential transformation, not focusing on the negative states which have enabled you to recognise which remedy is needed. You know?
So the negative state is basically a diagnostic tool to enable you to tell really which remedy it is that you're after. Yeah. And what the remedies are aiming to do is move people towards a position in which they can become gentle and firm, courageous. Courageous and constant are interesting, aren't they? Courageousness and courage and constancy.
Courage and constancy, yeah. Because I was saying earlier on, I don't think it's possible to be temporarily courageous in this world, really, because I think if we're going to be courageous, then we need to be constant in that, because it's very difficult. If you're going to get rid of the fear, then you're going to feel courageous. You're going to be courageous in a world where fear is being propagated around us at a rate of knots, you know, all the time.
And I guess there are, I mean, you can use the flower remedies as a kind of prophylactic, if you like, but I guess there must be ways of kind of maintaining these attitudes without reaching for the flower remedies.
Yeah, I mean, the flower remedies are just one of many ways of helping people to tune in to, call it what you like, you know.
The greater field of energy.
The greater field of energy. And I mean, one way of doing this that I'm quite passionate about, as you know, is spending time in nature. Even if you can only find a very small patch of nature, then we can still be inspired by it, you know. And it can, being in nature it's a communication, it's a communion, it's not a one-way process, you know. As the more time you spend in nature, the more you will receive and give and understand. It's a process, you know, being in nature. It's not like something we do on a Sunday afternoon for an hour and a half, you know. It's like something that can be a part of our lives. Yeah,
and indeed, I mean, Bach talks about the 38 plants that he singled out, or 38ed out, whatever the phrase is. He described them as plants of a higher order, which is, and some of them are trees, aren't they? And also, that's not to say that there aren't similar resonances to be got just from plants that aren't in Bach's list. I bet just being with plants helps, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, most definitely. I mean, if you can be immersed in nature for any length of time and feel at ease and commune with nature, then I think that's bound to have a healing effect on you, and you're going to be stronger when you leave that patch of nature than you were when you went in there. You know, it's a strengthening, healing thing to do. There's nothing disempowering about wading barefoot through the mud, being thigh deep in a bog or a river or whatever else, you know. I mean, immerse yourself in nature.
I know you like to immerse yourself in nature. Yeah, indeed. Yeah, you know me, I quite often prefer to have a nap. You do end up literally thigh deep in bogs, folks. If you go for a walk in hills with Synchro, you will be wading rivers and yes, definitely thigh deep in bogs. That is absolutely no exaggeration. I can find people who've heard on the show who will be a witness to that. So yeah, immersing yourself in nature as a helpful thing to do. And what Bach reckons basically is that if you can't kind of reach towards these ideal soul qualities, or if these faults arise in you, what do we think of the faults? Are they arising in us? Are they part of our conditioning? Are they encouraged in us by society, or a mixture of all? Where do these so-called faults come from? Actually, there was, I think Rick Fields put in here, he put in, where does the negative come from? Let's just find the question. The negative comes from past emotion or egoic pain. Where do you think the faults arise?
It's a very interesting question, and I'm not sure I've got all the answers, but something that springs to mind is really that we're not talking about faults in the sense of things which can't be transformed. What we're talking about is negative emotional states, which are only negative because we've lost touch with the positive manifestation of that trait. So if I can think of an example, for example, well, take an agrimony type, if you like. If somebody in the need of agrimony has got all sorts of tortured thoughts going on inside, which they will then cover up with a cheerful facade. And that the transformation of that by taking agrimony means that you would be presenting a more realistic facade or a realistic face on how you feel that day, rather than pretending to be cheerful because what's going inside is nobody's business. So you're able to be more honest about what's going on inside, and if somebody asks you how you are, you're more honest, you're more able to be honest about how you feel. So it's about, you've got the trait, you've got the enthusiasm, but you're being a bit dishonest in the way you portray how you feel. About bringing that round to honesty and putting it out there.
Yeah. And if we don't manage to find our way into these positive virtues, as it were, these what he calls ideal soul qualities, we start to see things like pride and cruelty and hatred and ignorance and greed manifesting around us, which of course is it's never going to be helpful in your life, is it?
No, and the sooner you can get to people who are demonstrating those traits you've just read out, the sooner you can get to those people, then the more likely you are to be able to avert those extremely negative states we've just been talking about: pride, cruelty, hatred, self-love, ignorance and greed. I mean, these are quite advanced negative manifestations of inner states, which all our behavior is a manifestation of an inner state. So the sooner you can get there to treat a person using whatever form of healing you're going to use, the better. Then they won't develop into these extremely negative states, which might lead to causing harm, loss and damage, and using anger in a very negative way, using violence, for example, which has a negative manifestation of anger. Yeah.
Well, these things, as we say, would tend to tarnish our intention and defile our inspiration, and they tend to, I guess, if you're in these kind of states for any length of time, they tend to encourage a feedback from the world which just leads to more pride and cruelty and ignorance and greed.
Yeah, it does seem to be the case that, if somebody's walking down the street feeling angry and scowling, then it's highly likely that they're going to attract a bit of that to themselves by doing so. You know what I mean? I'm not saying everybody's got to smile their heads off all the time, but at least if you're feeling relatively immune to the influences of others, and a lot of the remedies do actually focus on that, is to give you some immunity and not be so easily buffeted around by the moods and feelings of other people that you meet. You meet quite a lot of anger in the world, for example, but not to be too affected by somebody else's anger and come at them from a place of centered, basically feeling good about yourself and not taking it on board, then you're more likely to be able to diffuse that anger.
Bit of gentleness, wisdom and joyfulness.
Yeah. Do something crazy, random acts of kindness, or do something mad, and hopefully you'll be able to diffuse the angry centre.
And ultimately, I mean, we know, don't we? Well, we hear quite a lot, don't we, that the germ theory of disease can't be right, else doctors would be permanently sick and all that kind of stuff. But as far as Eddie Bach's concerned, it's these negative feelings, these negative soul states that are ultimately responsible for disease. And he reckons that actually, left to ourselves, we all desire to live in harmony. And that if we were living in harmony, resonance with each other, that's the most effective energy state. I personally think that is our natural state, but we're pretty much encouraged one way or the other, aren't we, not to be living in constancy and harmony with each other.
Yeah, well, I don't want to criticise anybody personally, but if your first recourse, if you're feeling a bit out of sorts, is the pharmacy, then I think it would probably be a really good idea to look at some other forms of healing, because it's all about taking our own power and in our own hands and being able to do something about it for ourselves, you know. I mean, these essences, anybody can make them. They can be free to anybody who can be bothered to make them. They're available. All you need is sunshine and a bowl of water. You know, they are totally accessible. There's nothing remote or strange about them. You know, they're just flowers and water and sunshine. So anything we can do, which is a positive step in the direction of our own healing, doesn't matter what you do. Basically,
I notice Eddie Bull's putting now. He's put, I've seen babies show pride, ignorance, anger, and greed, so I'm not that concerned.
Yeah, well, I mean, we all have our unique tendencies and talents and creative abilities, even from the moment of conception. They're there. So the baby that's born and how the baby's born, how it's received, how it's treated when it leaves the womb, all those things are going to play a great part.
Even what happens to it when it's in the womb, we're told. It knows that the father's not there. I guess what music it's played, whether its parents are fighting and arguing around it. All of these things must register. The mother's diet, loads of things.
Everything. I mean, I think it happens from the moment of conception and even before the moment of conception. There is a choice being made. That's probably going somewhere else right now. But, you know, I think even from the moment of conception, we have these inclinations which will manifest from the minute we're born. And it is very possible to treat babies with the Bach flower remedies. And the way you diagnose, apparently, for a baby is, although I haven't done much of it, I've treated mothers with babies that they were having a difficult time with. And that's fine because the baby then gets the, hopefully, the relaxing and the reducing of stress in the mother as a result of taking the remedies. And obviously, possibly even through the breast milk, actually receiving the remedy. And it's helped enormously. If you want to treat a baby, you can put a remedy in the baby's cot and see what the baby's reaction is to the frequency of that bottle of remedy. Yeah. So if it calms the baby down, you can think, yeah, okay, we'll give the baby some of this. And again, I wouldn't recommend more than two or three remedies. Mm. You could give rescue remedy to a baby who is in an extreme state, in its drink, in its milk, or in its warm water, or whatever you're giving.
But you can get some result just by putting it in the cot.
Yeah, yeah. Apparently that's been done. So in a way, the baby is telling you through its change of mood or which remedy is the best one for them. Yeah. You could also use dowsing, but if the baby can tell you, then why not go straight to the baby?
Looks like Mahatma's just joined us. Good evening, Mahatma Coat. He's saying he would have missed the bit about how it is they work and how you diagnose, but you might as well have a go at this. What does Bach recommend for insomnia, please, and or headaches?
Well, it depends, really, on the reason for the insomnia. Because there could be many different reasons for not being able to get to sleep. But there is one remedy that is often used, and that is white chestnut, which is for if you've got thoughts from the daytime, from your waking time, going round and round in your head, and you can't sort of turn them off, which is a common reason for insomnia, then white chestnut is a really good idea. Again, I'd have to have a chat with the person to find out what the reasons for the insomnia are, because it could be other things, but it is quite often white chestnut. It could be that you're particularly worried or concerned about another person. So there's several remedies depending on the nature of your concern for that other person or that group of people. Then there are remedies which could be, the right remedy would need to be chosen for your particular kind of concern. So again, you'd need to have a personal chat, but you could take a guess that white chestnut might be a good one to start with.
Yes, indeed. And they do help with things like migraines and insomnia on occasions, don't they? Because you're dealing with the emotional state of the individual that's behind their disease. That's the thing. I mean, we're just kind of getting there, really, in that as you develop as a result either of your own history or as a result of influences that surround you or the lifestyle that you find yourself living, you develop these faults or failures in virtue or whatever we want to call them. And as a result, you start to become disconnected. There's a feeling of disruption in your life. There's a feeling of congestion and friction instead of easy flow. Things become distorted, disharmonious. These are the kind of, if you like, the external reflection of what's going on. But what it results in, according to Bach, first of all, before you get to the physical illness and the kind of symptoms we're talking about there, what you get first of all is negative moods. Is that right?
Yeah, because with headaches, it's you don't approach a Bach flower session focusing on the headache, for example. You want to get to the reasons behind the headache. So it's not like you're giving a painkiller or an aspirin. You're actually trying to find out the causes of the disease or the unease that has led to the headache. Headaches are quite often associated with stress, but the reasons for the stress will be different in many people.
Yeah, I mean, let's face it, it's amazing that anybody's not under stress in this society, given the way it's running.
Well, yes, you could say that, and I think that's probably true. But I think if we're aiming towards a state of inner relaxation and peace, and that we recognise that we're going to be better able to deal with the world as we find it, if we're in a state of inner equilibrium and peace, then it's something worth striving for. And that means that we are going to be working on things, the things which give us stress, or the things that we allow to stress us would be more accurate, then we're going to want to lessen those aspects in our lives, or at least take some time out from those stressful situations we find stressful, to do things that we find relaxing and to make some space for that in our lives, even if it's just 5 minutes sitting quietly during the day somewhere, or going for a walk, sitting by a river, you know, watching some birds. I spent some time watching the birds, the swans, doing their preening and some of their mating dances up on the lake today. And it was time well spent, in my opinion, because I went completely out of time. The sun was practically blinding me, and these swans were just achingly beautiful, doing their thing, being swans, without any of the existential angst that we people tend to feel quite often.
I know people say that it's easy to make the 15 minutes every day or whatever, but it's equally easy not to make it, isn't it? But you think it's really worth it, important to do that?
I do. And, you know, everybody needs to find their own way of doing that. And if it's 5 minutes whilst washing up, looking out the window, then that's also possible. I think it's just up to us to find the way to give ourselves a bit of space to tune into the mediator between us and the universe, and to feel that we are actually communicating with the greater grid, the consciousness grid, if you like, that surrounds and possibly is a part of the planet that we're standing on. It just, for me anyway, tuning into that kind of thought helps me to feel a part of this greater whole that we've been talking about. And that we're not isolated. There is nothing isolated about our existence at all. We are totally interconnected, interdependent, interrelated, and inseparable in terms of our survival on this planet. And the sooner we recognise that, the better.
Which is, and that's something that we keep seeing emphasised in the Bach Flower Remedies, isn't it? And he says that basically, There's sort of two fundamental errors. Again, I like it because it's pretty simple. And he says the first one is not acting in accord with your own soul's mission or your own soul's desire, but persisting in the illusion of being separate, which is exactly what you were saying. This feeling that we're part of a bigger unity is really important. And he's saying that not only do people begin to feel separate, but sometimes it gets to the point where they don't even recognize that there is a soul or a higher self. And at that point, you get to accept only what can be seen and touched. And you and I both know that there is a whole world of stuff beyond what we can see and explain.
Certainly is. I mean, I find it quite hard to believe that there's anybody out there listening to the radio tonight who doesn't recognise that there are many things. What does Hamlet say? Many things in heaven and earth that
more
are
more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in our philosophy.
Horatio. Or like you know, that. There are many things beyond which can be seen and touched, and I do believe that many of us have had experience of those. The more we can tune into that stuff, the better. You know, like what do you call it? The morphogenetic field, the consciousness grid. Whatever, the more people who are tuning into that, then the more effect and influence we can have on the whole thing.
So that's an important thing. You're getting a lot of support here. Nick's saying synchro's spot on, make an effort to step out of time in nature, and it's always worth it, even just watching the birds in the garden. And Laurie agrees. And basically what we're saying is that because of the morphic field and because actually of your unity with all of mankind and everything that's going on, by doing that, you're not only helping yourself by definition, you're making a little bit of difference to the whole as well.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, this isn't about a power trip. It really isn't about a power trip, because the more sentient beings on this planet who can tune into the fact that we are affecting, influencing, and on a frequency level, it's really important what we think, what we do, what we say on an everyday basis is really, really important. And we are having an effect, and every single being on this planet is having their effect. It's just that the more conscious we can become of the fact that we're having an effect, then we can make it as a positive and as beneficial an effect as we possibly can. The more people that do that, the more shared that job becomes, that responsibility to be people of peace, living in peace on the planet with a state of inner peace that is guiding us, then the less conflict there will be. That's what that old statement means. Inner peace leads to world peace. And a lot of people find that statement quite challenging, and I can understand why. When I first heard it, I thought it was quite challenging too. But the more I seek to practice and firm up that concept of inner peace, the more I come to believe it's true.
And acting in consistency with the principle of unity is the way of becoming peaceful inside, isn't it? And he emphasises a special case of not doing that, of failing to act, or acting against the principle of unity, he says, which we do particularly if we try to force our will upon another, especially if that's being against the will of the latter. And my goodness, we see a lot of that going on, don't we? We see a lot of coercion.
We certainly do. And that just makes me want to treat the person who's trying to impose their will on another, because there is a remedy for that. And that, again, that has gone to the extremely negative polarity of the effect of a particular remedy called vine. And anybody who's imposing themselves on others or imposing their will on others against their own, that person's will or that group of people's will, is definitely acting against unity, the unity principle. Yeah.
And they are, of course, impeding their own development as well as impeding the development of the person they're imposing themselves on. And because of that, they're doing a pretty good job of upsetting the whole cosmic energy field as well. So you're actually not only interrupting your own development, you're also interrupting the development of mankind as a whole. So you should be ashamed of yourself, people. Stop doing it. And it's interesting, Mechtel Schaefer defines greed as the negative side of tolerance and love for one's neighbour, and that it kind of saying that it leads to a desire for power, and thus a denial of freedom and the individuality of every free soul, which is, again, fair point, isn't it?
Yeah, it certainly is. And we can see a lot of evidence of people acting from a point of greed and a desire for power. I don't think it's going to get them any benefit in the end. And the sooner they realise that, the better. That this isn't an effective way to use this gift of life we've been given.
No, I love that quote which said, every one of us is here to develop freely upon his own lines, according to the dictates of the soul alone, to increase his individuality, to work free and unhampered. The personality with greed desires to dictate, on the other hand, to mould and command, and usurps the power of the creative life principle.
Yeah, that's quite a statement, isn't it? Usurping the power of the creator, or the creative life principle, trying to lay your will onto others with such force that it's going to cause destruction, disease, war, distress, and all those things.
And of course, we would appear to have an entire system that is attempting to put itself between us and the prime creative force.
Yeah, I think we talk about it quite a bit, and there's many, many things that are quite popular, like stuff that's in the mass media is nothing but part of the a weapon of mass distraction, as I've heard it called in one of the songs you play. You know, they're very good. There's many, many, many distractions in the world. But I think, as it says, I think in the bit about simplicity, if we can value the simple things in life without denigrating them as being something primitive. And personally, I think there's nothing wrong with something primitive if primitive means sitting round a fire, whittling sticks and having a cup of tea with your friends.
Sitting up to your arse in a bog somewhere.
You know, simplicity in those terms is something to be just really valued. And like I said, even walking in a woodland can be an incredibly complex experience for the senses. If you immerse yourself in the birdsong and the wind in the trees, and there's nothing simple about it in a negative sense, but it is simplicity itself, because you don't have to do much. You just have to tune in and be there properly.
Yeah, so conflicts basically arising from this kind of state, especially arising from a state in which you find yourself imposing your will upon other people, or indeed in any sense impeding their freedom or hampering their ability to explore their own personality and their own development, then persistent conflicts in this area eventually lead to symptoms in the body. And I guess on a wider scale, possibly to symptoms in the wider body of humanity as a whole as well.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, many, many people in the so-called West are pretty reliant on pharmaceutical drugs now. And like I say, I don't want to judge anybody who is in that position, but I do hope that at some point they will manage to look at that and look maybe for some other ways of combating their disease or their problems, and not to continue taking those for the rest of their lives, because they're not probably going to be beneficial in the long term.
Yes, because as Schaefer points out, that but you kick off with a sense of disruption and disconnection in the life around you, you end up in negative emotional states, which can be the first signal you get that it really ought to be a good idea to start addressing some of this inner stuff. And then eventually it manifests itself as physical symptoms now, which he describes as a red light. And I remember Darko, when he was on with Fairport recently, another great podcast worth listening to, that one, he was saying that the red light's the equivalent to one of those red lights you get on your dashboard, and they can be really bad, can't they? They can mean that your transmission's going, and when you look them up in the manual, as I've had to do on occasions in the past, they generally say pull over straight away and consult an expert or something like that. Now, effectively, what Darko was saying was with the allopathic medicines, what they're doing is they're shutting out the symptoms. So effectively, they're just reaching behind the dash and cutting the wires to the red light, which isn't going to help. Whereas the Bach flower remedies, Bach flower therapies, takes a completely different approach, doesn't it? What it's actually doing is it's taking these negative soul states that are arising as a result of basically bad attitudes and bad approaches to others, disadvantageous approaches to others. And he takes those negative soul states, and those are what are the basis of, they're the basis of the diagnosis, as far as I can tell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, you know, it's not about judging or focusing on these negative traits. As you said earlier on, they are a means of diagnosis. And if you can catch the person before any physical symptoms have manifested, then all well and good, because you're likely to be able to help them from occurring. But if the physical disease has manifested, you are not focusing on the disease when you're treating with Bach flower remedies. You're looking at the the attitude and the state of mind and the emotional state of the person in response to that disease, because that will tell you a lot about them. So that's what you do. You look behind, you ignore the disease.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say. You effectively ignore the disease, because I guess if you don't ignore the disease, then like everything else, you're giving it energy, aren't you?
Yeah, and you're giving it your focus, which is also the same, you could say the same as giving energy. If you meet somebody with, for example, if you meet somebody with a severe physical disability or deformity or a facial deformity, if you focus on that, then you're going to be supporting their view that that is the most noticeable thing about them. If you can talk to the person behind the disability or behind the disfiguration, then you're speaking to the sentient being behind what might be initially a bit shocking. Yeah. And that's the way you're going to talk to the person behind and get to talk to them, by ignoring anything that might be physically manifest and in your face.
Yeah. And the idea then is not to overcome or fight the symptoms, but as that also would maintain them in their energy field, as it were. Instead, the idea is to flood them with a more harmonious energy waves. That's basically the approach, isn't it? The flowers themselves embody a frequency that's in tune with a similar quality or frequency in the human energy field. And that's what you're trying to do. You're reaching to the positive energy field's still within there. And you're reaching to it with a positive energy field from the outside world, very much like Paracelsus and the other guy, Hahnemann, the father of homeopathy, were doing. So the idea is to build on that good frequency rather than tackle any perceived disadvantageous frequencies.
Yeah, I think it says somewhere, doesn't it, that given the right remedy or combination of remedies, the potential transformation is felt from the instant you start taking the remedy. That transformation will start to happen, and you are flooding the dis-ease or the unease with good vibrations, so that the forming disease or the potential disease, which might not yet be manifest, will melt away like snow in the sunshine. And I really like that analogy. You know, that's what you're doing, is you're enabling the unease to become irrelevant, disappear.
I like the idea that, the, you know, the flowers themselves represent a given frequency. Presumably the negative state of the flowers is a bit of an opposing frequency. So by putting the one in to contact with the other, you slowly but surely flatten out the one that's not giving you any help. And then because these other frequencies are resident in our spirit, because they're in the flowers, they're actually in our bodies as well, because we're a fractal part of the holographic whole. And that means eventually you start reinforcing the more joyful end of the spectrum through, again, through what do they call it? It's like a standing wave. Resonance. I think that's another more complicated phrase, but that was obviously not going to come at the moment. So that's how they're working. Do you remember that YouTube video we saw of somebody dipping a flower in water and then photographing it?
Yeah, that was amazing. They had a big jug of water. They plunged a flower into this jug of water and then took it out and took a pipette, took droplets from this water and put it onto a screen so that they could be viewed through a microscope. And these drops of water had actually taken on the form of that flower. You could see it in each drop of water. And what was even more amazing was that each person who put out a row of drops of water from the same vase had an influence on the image that was retained in their drops of water.
Yeah, I think you're kind of conflating a couple of things there. One of them in the video, they dipped the flower into the water, and I can't remember what sort of camera it was they were using, but they did see basically a reflection of the flower shape in the water.
In the vase.
Now, what when you're thinking of the other individuals, what they were each encouraged to do, I think, was put down 3 or 4 drops of water on a microscope slide. They all took their water from the same vase of purified water or whatever, and then these were looked at under an Emoto type microscope, and the result was that there were 4 individuals, each of whom put down 4 drops of water on a slide, and each individual's drops of water looked pretty different from the drops of water that were made by the other 3 individuals, even though they'd all come from the same vase. And also the 4 drops that were put down by each individual were similar to each other, but all of them were completely unique as well. So just by taking a pipette of water and by putting on a microscope slide, people's energetic systems were making a difference to the way the water was working. And of course we now know that you can everything's got its own frequency. That includes us. We're a pile of really complicated frequencies, but I'm told that just like the stars, we do have our own unique and identifiable frequency. I don't know how you measure it. And everything else is like that as well. So mistletoe and argon and everything has its own frequency. Everything is distinguished from everything else by that. And I gather that you can record the frequency for something like, say, argon or, I don't know, magnesium or whatever. You can record it. Send it as an email, attach it as a sound file to an email, send it across the world, and somebody can open it on the other end, play it to a glass of water, and the glass of water reacts as if you actually put some of this stuff in there. So it's pretty amazing. It is a pretty amazing means of transmitting energy, water is, and of course, fundamentally, that's what's happening. You mentioned it quickly earlier. Do you just want to explain briefly how these remedies are made? Because it only takes a couple of minutes.
Well, a lot of them are made by what Bach called the sunshine method, which involves going out on a sunny morning. If you can find a nice sunny morning with a blue sky, that'd be lovely. And taking a bowl of water with you, with as clean a water as you can get your hands on, spring water, clean water, filtered water, if that's the best you can do. And then fill the bowl with water, pick the flowers or the parts of the plant that you're going to use. It's mostly the flowers. Put those in the water and leave it in the sunshine for about 4 hours, 3 to 4 hours. And I reckon if you spend a bit of time sitting with that bowl of water in the sunshine as well, giving it your good intent and good thoughts and good vibes, then that will probably help turn it into a more effective essence. And when that's done, you strain the flowers out of the water and then you take the water and mix it half and half with the alcohol of your choice, be it brandy or vodka or whatever, and that makes up your stock essence. And from that, you only need to take two tiny drops to put into a dropper bottle of spring water to treat somebody with the energy of that essence. Now, anybody can do this with anything they fancy doing it with. The other group of plants in the remedies are made with the boiling method. So things like chestnut bud and quite a few others are made using the boiling method.
Do we know how he decided which ones could be done with the cold and the sun, which ones needed to be boiled?
I think it's to do with the physical properties. Like I say, it would be difficult with an unopened chestnut bud to use the sunshine method. Be more difficult, I think. So the boiling method was used, I think, to do with the physical nature of the parts of the plant that were being used.
Okay. So what we're saying is that each remedy, there's 38 plants. So basically, they represent, I guess, 38 soul qualities or virtues, 38 different sparks of the divine, each of which is housed in these individual plants. And then each of those remedies has the same harmonious energy frequency as the human soul quality, and that by exposing the one to the other, the affinity, they say, establishes contact with the virtue and re-establishes harmony in the soul. Is that it? And then he says, like music and colour therapy, which is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it's interesting that they should be... it's all to do with frequency, isn't it? And we know that colour has a big effect on us. And that we can actually change the way we feel quite dramatically just by wearing a different coloured shirt or pair of socks.
You're actually into colour therapy sometime after you got into Bach Flower Remedies. It was subsequent, wasn't it? And am I right in thinking there's sort of key energies associated with the colours?
There certainly are, yeah. And, well, we were talking... You could, for example, the guy I worked with, Theo Gimbel, they'd spent a lot of time, his group, coming up with keywords for each of the 8 colours of the spectrum. And his keyword for turquoise was immunity. And I've actually recommended this to people and I've tried it out myself. If you wear a turquoise shirt or turquoise socks or turquoise undies or anything, but preferably where people can see it, then this is going to give you immunity to being too easily influenced by what's going on around you and by the thoughts and emotions of the people around you.
It does change the way you feel, and it also changes the way people respond to you. I guess it's more likely to work as a t-shirt than undies, depending on how much of your lingerie you're prepared to show.
Yeah, I think if you can wear it so that it can be seen by others, then it's more likely to work on them as well. If you're wearing turquoise undies and socks, which might not be seen, then you're working on your state rather than other people's state at the same time. But yeah, I mean, we all know that wearing a red... you had a full red boiler suit.
Bloody asking for trouble,
you know, wearing red. But the key word in that system for red is energy. So if you're feeling a bit low in energy, you might well try to put on a pair of red socks or a pair of red shoes, a pair of red jeans, a red shirt.
So we've got energy and immunity for red and turquoise, which are also complementary colours, aren't they? Could we explain complementary colours? Because this is all to do with frequency and it's working on the same basis as the flower essences.
Yeah, it's true, exactly the same. Mm. Well, you could, in fact, combine colour therapy and the Bach flower therapy because, for example, with the immunity and the turquoise, there are several remedies which work with people's immunity to outside influences. You could support that with the Bach remedies.
Yeah. What about the other colours? What about yellow? What's that associated with?
Well, yellow is, it's to do with, surprisingly perhaps, it's to do with the intellect and emotion. And yellow is also the colour of the solar plexus, isn't it? The key colour associated with the solar plexus. So I think it's a lot to do with that sort of gut feeling thing that we have with yellow. Instinct, emotion. And even the intellect, yeah. So yellow being the the complementary colour of yellow being violet, and that is to do with dignity. Violet's a very special colour, and if you think of certain people who perhaps play what might be called dignified roles, then violet plays a big part.
Are there Bach flower remedies that are associated with dignity issues?
Yes, there are. Yeah, that you could say that. Water violet, for example, is for somebody who is aloof to the point of becoming remote and out of touch with people, and often appear dignified and calm. But by taking the water violet remedy, it would bring that aloofness to a more communicable state, so that they'd be able to relate more easily to other people, and so not become isolated, because they feel isolated and they become isolated as a result. So yeah, there is. So that's yellow, that's yellow and violet.
Red and blue, they're etheric counterparts.
They are in...
Red and blue, they're etheric counterparts, aren't they?
They are. Red, as we've said, is for energy, and blue is for calm. So you can imagine, can't you? Somebody once told me that if you only had one toilet in the house and you wanted people to move through the toilet in the morning as quickly as possible, you would paint the inside of your toilet bright red, bright pillar box red. If you wanted people to take it easy and take their time in the toilet, you might paint the inside of your toilet blue, because that would calm people down and enable them to take their time. So you can actually affect how people behave in different coloured rooms.
That's well known, isn't it, from the way they paint hospitals and prisons and things like that. They well tend to use pale blues and pale greens rather than bright reds if they want to keep people calm. So we have blues for calm, oranges for joy, is it?
Yeah, oranges for joy. They couldn't come down on the side of one word for orange, so it was joy and dance in the same box.
So is that all eight of the colours?
No, I think you've still got to do pink and green, magenta and green.
Of course, yeah, pink and green. Magenta is all about letting go and change. That's what magenta is about. And magenta is that bright fuchsia pink, or the far end of the spectrum in the rainbow. When they're on about black. And green is for balance, because green is at the centre of the colour spectrum. So therefore it's a colour of balance. It is quite frequently associated with nature being the colour of growth in nature. So yeah, green, balance, magenta, pink, letting go and change. So you know, if you need to if you want to feel more balanced, take a walk in the green park, under the greenwood tree, bring you to more balance. And if you want to bring about some radical change in your life, you want to wear a bright pink shirt, some bright pink socks, and yeah, magenta coloured undies, you know.
Is it helpful to wear the complementary colours at the same time? So go out there dressed in magenta and green. Not that I do that too often, but would it work for me if I did?
Well, if you were going to treat it like, it depends which colour you needed most. So say you really needed orange loads, you were going out to do a major dancing session and you were going to be dressed in predominantly in orange, you might want to have a little bit of blue on you to balance that. But no need to have loads of blue, just a little bit to balance that energy. Whereas if you wanted to go out and, I don't know, have a very calm session of dance, you might balance the colours more in what you were wearing and wear sort of half of each or something.
But the complementary colours are helpful worn in pairs. Definitely.
When you're doing a colour therapy treatment, you certainly treat both with both colours, because you're working with the two energies of the spectrum. Yeah.
So we're saying that colours are frequency, just like each of these individual flower essences are frequencies as well. The essay with Mechtild Schaefer compared it with music, and really colours kind of music for the eyes. It is a frequency. And really, this is exactly what we were saying when we were talking about the template ceremonies and the fact that the geometry seeks for resonant counterparts inside your energetic structure with which to resonate. That's exactly the same thing. The geometry does it as well. I recently did the introduction to sacred geometry for a university of the third age, which I think anybody who's not in full-time work can come along to that. And I was, although it does have to say it, generally the senior part of the local population. And I was amazed. There was over 120 people there. It was a very big room. And they were extremely keen. And just like every time we do that talk, at the end of it, there's just a kind of wave of people who come and want to look at the geometry. They want to handle it. They want to peer at it and experience it close up. And I'm pretty sure that the reason they do that is because it genuinely is reaching for a resonance inside people. What about black? We had a question there. Well, first of all, Jimmy says if he wants to move people on through the loo quickly, he just doesn't flush. What about black? Or what about black and white?
Well, I think it's right to say that black is actually, some people think that black reflects all the other colours, but I think that black actually absorbs all of the other colours until nothing but black can be seen. So it's a kind of sink for all the other colours, which appears to be dark, but is actually quite colourful. And white, I think, reflects all of the other colours, leaving nothing but white to be seen. And of course, you know, red doesn't exist the way we see it in the outside world. It is our brain furniture that turns it into red, and it is the consensus that allows us to agree about the nature of the colour red. And many people can't see black. For example, they're colorblind to black. So they will see other colors instead of black. And many people are colorblind. It's a very interesting condition, color blindness. Many people will see red as green and green as red. Working in a garden center, that can be quite awkward because somebody will tell you to move all the red geraniums. But if you can only see green flowers, then that can be quite difficult. So, colour blindness is a very interesting condition, and it goes to show really that our perception of colour is mostly in the mind, not in the colour itself. Yeah. Whereas with colour therapy, quite often you're using coloured light, which has a higher frequency, the actual electricity used to shine the coloured light onto people is a higher frequency than the colour in a t-shirt.
Yeah.
Am I right in saying that?
I think if you're using good quality stained glass and good full spectrum light, which is what the light therapy machines use. So we just go back to the bar flower remedies just briefly before perhaps going for a music break, because you've gone for a fair crack now. You've been going for over an hour. Well done. So the idea is that by exposing the human to these very subtle resonances that slowly but surely a type of internal order can be restored. There is once more a movement towards unity and harmony and gentleness, peacefulness, courage, constancy, all those things that are defined as positive character traits, and less of a likelihood to go out there and cause arguments and feel upset and jealous and angry and stressed out and all the rest of it. But that absolutely fundamental to all of this is an ability and a willingness to grasp the fact that one is part of a greater whole, that one is not, in fact, separate from things, and that one is, in the final instance, part of a system that's governed by a unified, simple, creative principle. I love this idea that the thing's basically simple, and that it's the primary aim and outcome of Bach flower therapy to restore and reaffirm this fundamental attitude in every human being. Oh, what a great idea, that target that is, isn't it?
Yeah, it certainly is. And that's why I think it's so worthwhile doing. And I'm determined to use them as much as possible, really, and to dole them out to whoever fancies having a go, because I need the practice. And the more practice I can have, then the more benefit I feel. I take them myself on a regular basis. So self-diagnosis is a very good way of learning about the energy of the remedies, and that can only help me to become more open and able to diagnose for other people.
Nick Nomic's put in there, Doc, are you sure this is not just a pigment of your colourful imagination? Very good. Thanks very much for being out there, folks. You are, of course, listening to Dr. Rock's radio show here on peoplesinternetradio.com.
Thanks all.
iPhone 5 NSA is the best surveillance device to date. It is a meticulously designed tracker, recorder, and data collector. Every single government agency, authority, and police officer has been considered to make sure iPhone 5 NSA can keep you safe and protect your freedom. This care, this consideration, it extends to how we collect information pertaining to you and everyone you know. And it's what led us to create Touch ID, the largest name-to-fingerprint database in the world.
Touch ID defines the next step of how we use your iPhone. With just a touch of your home button, Touch ID reads your fingerprint so you can collect the latest apps or purchase shiny new Apple products, while we track your location through GPS and transmit data back to corporations and government.
Our employees are literally working around the clock, in some cases 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, to assemble each iPhone 5 NSA individually. And now we require all of them to sign an anti-suicide pledge to ensure our production meets your, the consumer's, demand. And just in case that doesn't work, we've installed suicide nets all along the perimeter of our 24-to-a-room dormitories to gently catch even the most demoralized and broken-down souls and safely return them to the workplace so there's enough iPhones for you and your entire family.
iPhone 5 NSA uses speech recognition technology, so you don't have to bother yourself with remembering things or consulting your brain for any information ever again. Just ask it for the time, the day of the week, what your name is, sports scores, anything, really. You can ask it anything. It puts your brain in your hand and into our database.
We've also developed what we like to call blackout technology, which allows authorities to block video and photos whenever they feel your security is in danger. For instance, if a political rally is ambushed by a conspiracy theorist demanding answers, the police can black out every phone in the crowd so his questions are never heard or seen by anyone.
Reporters, do your job, please ask some questions.
And once he's silenced and his coordinates are locked in, iPhone 5 NSA takes care of the rest.
Just a question, man. How are we supposed to know the truth when we can't even ask a question? It was just a question. That's all it was.
iPhone 5 NSA. Aiming to put your freedom in the crosshairs. Plenty more videos where that came from. Click the links below and don't forget to subscribe to Joy Camp and We Are Change. For your safety.
There you go, that was the iPhone NSA advert from We Are Change and Joy Camp. There's quite a lot of interesting and funny stuff on their channel. It's definitely well funny depending on how you look at it. That one particularly is great because the guy gets taken out by a missile attack which is homed on his mobile phone, which is actually happening to people. Of course, this is the way drones appear to work and all of that, but personally I found it quite an amusing little clip. I enjoyed that. Before that, we were hearing that the mix I promised you last week of Beer Drinkers and Hellraisers from Motorhead, the early years. What a crazy mix that one is, especially those background backing vocals. Must have taken them ages and ages to choreograph them. Before that, Molly Hatchet, Flirting with Disaster. Great tune. Personally, I think the Beer Drinkers and Hellraisers mix was Flirting with Disaster in a totally different way.